Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hellett. Well, we usually begin our program with our WFPL News Roundtable to talk about what we've been covering this week, and we'll get to that shortly, but this is an extraordinary week, and it calls for us to break format today and begin our program with college basketball in the NCAA tournament. Here to sort it all out for us is Mark Bacon, the co-host of Nothing But Net, the college basketball podcast. You can hear at WFPL.org. Mark is also our weekend edition Saturday host on WFPL. Mark, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. It's great to be here.
We're sort of sleepy this morning. We had a late night last night watching those basketball games. Let's start with the University of Louisville. This is considered
this is
an upset.
Stunning.
Right?
I mean, yeah, this is stunning.
Michigan State?
I think it's the most stunning upset beside Duke-Lehigh, perhaps in some ways, because Louisville has been in a lot of dogfights, or what I like to call rock fights, you know, with other teams, and have squeaked by but a double-digit beatdown of a number one seed, the first number one seed to fall in the tournament. This was just a remarkable achievement in about six, seven ways. I'm flabbergasted. It's kind of hard to talk about this if you've been a regular listener to Nothing But Net,
right?
And have me sitting here trying to talk to you with a mouthful of crow, but that's what I am right now.
Well, I was going to bring it up, unfortunately, because earlier I think I was on one of your podcasts,
yes,
and back in February, and you were mentioning the possibility of U of L going to the NIT, which is
exactly
like the consolation prize for those who get in the big tournament.
I mean, my only consolation is I wasn't the only person. I mean, we've had C.D. Kaplan on. I think Kaplan and myself had written off Coach Pitino with the injuries and all the travails this team had. To see where they've come since the Big East tournament is remarkable. And that's where I think this whole thing starts, is the Big East tournament. And that's where you began to see what I think the key to the victory was last night overall was conditioning. They took when Louisville presses you like they did last night and half for the last seven games, they take your legs out from you. And then the other things I think Coach Pitino mentioned in a presser, I guess last night, they guarded the perimeter very well, shut down the three-pointers. They cleared the backboards extremely well. And I also think that they shielded Gorky Zhang. This young man now probably has to play 40 minutes a game from here on out.
Yeah. And not to mention the uniforms.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. The so-called infrared uniforms.
Well, unfortunately, one of the uniforms went down last night with Cincinnati, but Baylor, you know, and Louisville. But yeah, it's got to be the infrared.
They're undefeated in the infrared uniforms, which one sports writer called hunting vest orange.
Yes, yes. But, you know, tomorrow night they'll be in the white uniforms. Yeah. So anybody who's looking at that are looking for bad omens. But just a remarkable achievement. Gorky Zhang really played a terrific game defensively. He still shows a lot of rawness in his game. He still needs some offensive components to be, I think, someone who's going to be more attractive at the next level. But Shane Bohannon last night, I'm willing to bet, I've not read this, I'm willing to bet scouts who were there, and there were plenty in attendance to look at Draymond Green, probably saw Shane Bohannon and probably started scribbling a lot of notes on him. He played like a beast last night.
And you can tell he has great potential.
Just he's got the body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got the body. Little Wes.
So next up for the Cards, Florida, coached by Billy Donovan, of course, who was a Pitino protege.
Yes, well, the Pitino coaching tree, I think you and I were talking earlier, has got to be over 20 people. And you think about Louisville Seton Hall, Louisville Cincinnati, now, you know, the ultimate Louisville and Billy the Kid down in Florida, probably Pitino's greatest product out of his coaching. This is a game that I think after watching the Florida game last night, this game is going to be very close. I don't expect any kind of blowout because both teams mirror each other so well. Last night, Florida spread the floor out well. Last night, I think Louisville won by pushing Michigan State out. So it'll be interesting to see how they go. I think it's going to be a dogfight, and it's Vegas right now. If you follow me on Twitter, I always have this Vegas knows things line because Vegas does know things when you look at those spreads. And Florida started out as a one-point favorite, then Louisville a point and a half. I think it's currently at one for Louisville. So it's pretty much a pick 'em.
When it goes to the Final Four, then tonight it's UK and Indiana. IU handed the Wildcats their first of just two defeats this season back in December. Can they do it again?
I don't think so at all. I think it's going to be a real reverse of what's going on, what had happened at the beginning of the season. Remember, the IU-UK game was the eighth game of the year. It was the first time, I think, that the freshmen for UK went into an extremely hostile environment with Assembly Hall. Mm-hmm. And as Matt and I said after the UK-IU game, this is going to be a different thing when it gets to a neutral court. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think there's a revenge factor. And, you know, these baby cats are now growing up Wildcats. And I expect UK to win by double digits.
Now, we're looking at some are already talking about the possibility of a UK-UofL Final Four matchup. This would be their first tournament match meeting, I guess, since 83, right?
Right, right. This would be, I hate to look that far down the road. I think it's a one game at a time type thing, because I think also if UofL wins against IU, which I expect they'll play Baylor. I think Baylor's one of the first teams in this tournament that can hand U of K a little bit of trouble, because Baylor's long and athletic, and they like to get up and down the court. And I'm not going to prognosticate now on the UofL Florida thing. It'd be great to see. The city would erupt, no doubt.
Well, it would be wild, wouldn't it?
Oh gosh.
And before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about Bellarmine. The Knights went down in defeat last night in the Final Four in the Division II tournament.
That was a heartbreaker, and I think injuries played a key part in that. Keyston Jones, who is the Ballard product from here in Louisville, broke his kneecap. That certainly hurt. And Luke Sprague, the player of the year for Division II, it's just his second game back from a shoulder injury, and he apparently looked very rusty. I didn't get to see the game, but it's a heartbreaker. The stars seem to be aligned for Bellarmine to move ahead, and so this is a kind of a bitter disappointment. I certainly am.
Defending champions, hoping to repeat for the first time since I think Cal State Bakersfield did it back in the early 90s, but great season nonetheless.
Really is. Scotty Davenport, another branch in the Patino coaching tree, has done a phenomenal job. And hats off to those guys. There's nothing to be ashamed of with that, but it is disappointing for I think everybody in the city.
Okay, you can hear Mark Bacon's podcast along with Matt Anthony, Nothing But Net, on WFPL.org. I guess you'll be updating quite a bit there.
We'll be recording probably on Monday. We'll probably have a new one up on Monday, because we want to wait and see the games play out.
All right, Mark
Bacon.
See how it
goes. Thanks a whole bunch, Rick.
Thanks for joining us, Mark. Mark Bacon from Nothing But Net on WFPL.org. Now let's welcome in our WFPL News Roundtable. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, and Devin Katayama. Welcome, everyone.
Hey.
And we, of course, welcome your input as we recap the week's developments. 502-814-TALK and 502-814-8255. Call us toll-free, 877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. You can send us an email at news@WFPL.org. Also send us a tweet at WFPL News. You can reach us through our Facebook page. Philip, let's start with you. Congressman John Yarmuth this week unveiled a proposal that would give us a little break on gasoline.
Well, at least vehicle owners. Congressman Yarmuth introduced on Monday the Gas Rebate Act of 2012. Essentially what this legislation could potentially do is that it calls to eliminate and close all of the loopholes and federal subsidies for oil companies. It would take about the $40 billion in savings from that, and through the IRS and through the Treasury Department, it would give vehicle owners approximately $160 per registered vehicle back in a one-time rebate. This is sort of similar, if people remember, when former President George W. Bush had a rebate, sort of a stimulus package where it was a direct rebate to taxpayers. This would apply to vehicle owners. So for the average Louisville family, according to Congressman Yarmuth's office, this would be about $300. Now, obviously, people don't have to spend this money on gas. They could spend it on whatever they want or put it back into savings, similar to what they did under the rebate under President Bush. But Congressman Yarmuth feels this is the only thing that can really be done to address gas prices in the short term. I believe gas has now hit nationally about an average of $3.88, $3.90. Here in Louisville, you see some stations flirting with $3.99, $4. So, you know, in many ways, you see gas prices becoming the new criticism of President Obama and his administration, particularly over the summers. Those gasoline prices are expected to reach over $4 as many Republicans begin to call for more drilling domestically.
Now, Congressman Yarmuth's measure has come under some criticism, as you might expect, from the other side of the aisle.
Sure. Obviously, there's little likelihood that Congressman Yarmuth's rebate act will pass the Republican-controlled House. But his Republican challenger here in the 3rd District, Brooks Wicker, who's a Louisville accountant, he came out and basically said that Congressman Yarmuth's act is a snake oil ploy, basically vote buying. He makes a point that if you look at the idea of giving back this rebate to vehicle owners, what about the taxpayers who don't own vehicles, who their money is going to the oil companies? Mr. Wicker, and I asked him if he supports closing the loopholes for oil companies. He wasn't necessarily sure, but he said no. At the end of the day, those loopholes do help the oil companies with exploration, with development, particularly those smaller oil companies. So he's not necessarily in favor of closing them at all, and really went after Congressman Yarmuth on this. The congressman's campaign did respond eventually to our request for comment, simply saying that he's focused on congressional matters, continuing to ignore Mr. Wicker, as the incumbent, Congressman Yarmuth, is considered the overall favorite in that race.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip. Devin Cadiano, let's turn to you because this week you covered a big event out at, mostly ceremonial, I guess, out at General Electric. But the CEO of the company was there, Jeff Immelt, to celebrate a new product.
Yeah, and he was actually also here to be the keynote speaker for the annual GLI meeting that they have every year. That took place earlier this week as well. Yeah, we knew that this product was going to be coming down the line. It's the second major appliance to be announced within the past 6 weeks that the appliance park out in Butuel is going to be manufacturing. And what it is a French door bottom loader freezer. And what they're really trying to do over at GE is redevelop the appliances industry. Obviously, because home sales and the home market hasn't been the best the past few years, there's some skepticism about how it's going to be really coming out from that downfall that we had earlier. And you got the sense that this really was a rally. And I'm going to play you a clip in a second. It's the first voice you're going to hear is the union leader, Jerry Carney. The second voice is going to be Mr. Immelt. But this is a sense of the over 1,000 employees that were present, how they're trying to rally the troops over there.
People all over the United States are looking right here at Louisville, Kentucky, at Appliance Park to see if it can be done. And I'm sure these people over here have took hits for bringing jobs back. They're saying you can't bring jobs back to America. Manufacturing's dead in America. But our CEO, at least he's standing up and saying that's not right. We can bring jobs back to America.
I will put the full faith, the brand, and in my own special way, I will specially motivate everybody in the sales force to make sure they sell the hell out of this product. Thanks very much.
And we're going to prove to the nation that right here in Louisville, Kentucky, we build a faster appliance with a higher quality than anybody else in the world. Thank you, and quit acting like Duke fans. Get up. Give yourself a Yale.
Oh my!
Oh man!
Yeah, it was pretty intense. They had a huge screen behind the speakers. Yeah, they're really into it, and you hear them talking about bringing jobs back to America. Part of this initiative is a campaign in here in the Louisville area, an $800 million investment, 1,000 jobs over the course of the next couple years through 2014. But those jobs that they're bringing back over here are starting at $13 an hour, which is about half what the current employees make, depending on their job skills at the time. But Immelt says, he said to the media afterwards that, you know, this is a competitive wage, that it will work itself out over time. I got the feeling that meant that the wages would be reconsidered later on, but right now they are going to stay at about $13 an hour.
Stop acting like Duke fans and get up and cheer. How about that?
Yeah, they definitely played to that end. But yeah, this French door investment, French door refrigerator investments, $250 million investment, 600 jobs. Some of those jobs, they had a posting up for 250 jobs last week. Immelt said 10,000 applicants were applied to those positions. So that gives you some kind of sense, at least according to him, about who's interested in the positions.
All right. Thank you, Devin. Erica Peterson, let's turn to you because you had more reporting this week on LG&E's proposal to convert its plant, the Cane Run plant, right, from coal to natural gas fired. What's going on this week?
Well, basically, LG&E has already gotten permission from the PSC to retire three of their coal-fired power plants, and one is Cane Run, and then there are two owned by Kentucky Utilities. So they've gotten permission to retire those plants, but they obviously have to make up the generation somehow. So right now, they're asking for permission to build a gas-fired power plant at Cane Run, as well as purchase an existing plant in Oldham County. And they're saying that will make up the generation they're losing by retiring these coal-fired plants. And they had the probably final step, if this is approved in this process this week, they had a formal hearing in front of the public service commissioners.
So I assume no one really spoke out against the proposal, but there are some that who want LG&E to like pursue other energy sources.
Yeah, they had a public meeting a couple of weeks ago, and the consensus there, obviously LG&E has had some problems with the neighbors around Cane Run who have been upset about the coal ash landfills on the property, and they're overjoyed that the company wants to stop burning coal. But the company is saying this will happen by 2016. So people were saying kind of, why can't we do this sooner? Why do we have to wait 4 years? And also, why are we moving to another fossil fuel in this? And at the hearing, the groups that spoke out against it, there are a couple of interveners in the case, the Attorney General's office, the Kentucky Industrial Utility Customers, and a group of coalition of environmental groups, the Sierra Club, Earth Justice. And the Sierra Club in particular has been really active in shutting down coal-fired power plants across the country. They have a Beyond Coal campaign. They've been kind of putting pressure on these plants to shut down. And when LG&E first announced that they were retiring these plants, they greeted that, you know, they were thrilled. Mm-hmm. But their argument now is they've crunched the numbers, and they say that LG&E isn't looking forward enough in this, and that they aren't accounting for perhaps a future limits on carbon dioxide. And of course, natural gas power plants emit a lot less carbon dioxide than, say, coal power plants, but they still do emit some. And so they're arguing that natural gas isn't actually going to be the cheapest way to go in this, and they should really consider some, you know, renewable energy and maybe just more beefed up energy efficiency programs so we don't actually consume as much energy in the area.
So when can we expect a decision in this request?
Well, there's technically no deadline for the commissioners to make a decision, but the company has asked for a decision by the end of April because they want to buy this Oldham County plant, and they say they have to know by then so the deal can go through.
All right. Thank you, Erica. Gabe Bullard, welcome back to the program. You've been gone for a while.
Yeah,
glad
it's
to have
good
you
to be back
here.
Yeah.
And you reported yesterday that the metro government is going to be cracking down again on parking scoff laws.
Yeah, now this is a change to the parking ordinance, the city's parking ordinance that the Metro Council made recently that will allow the Parking Authority of River City, or PARC, we'll be saying PARC left and right here for the next five mm-hmm. minutes. PARC can now and will now scan every car or check the license plate of every car, even if they're parked legally downtown, to see if the driver is one of these scofflaws who owes three or more unpaid tickets. If that person is, even if the car is parked legally, then there will be the immobilizing boot placed on the car that keeps you from driving away. Usually goes on the front driver's side wheel. This sounds a little bit familiar because in 2009, pretty much the same policy came out. There wasn't an actual law change, but PARC announced in the fall of 2009, the beginning in October of that year, they would boot cars legally or illegally parked if the drivers had two or more unpaid tickets. And that was pretty interesting in talking to PARC and in talking with officials with the mayor's office. It seems that people either didn't remember that PARC had planned to do this, and that there had been a significant PR rollout in the fall of 2009, or they simply said, well, we did say we were going to do that, but it never actually happened.
So do we have a handle on how many outstanding tickets people have three or more tickets?
There are about 19,000 of the scofflaws, they say. That adds up to millions of dollars. There's not an exact figure on it, but the city believes that if they start doing this, they'll be able to get more money to help fill this budget shortfall. That was one of the big reasons behind this. Mayor spokesman Chris Pointer said, I'll be honest, we need the money. And pretty much that's the case. The city's facing a $30 million projected shortfall for the next fiscal year. And if they could collect, say, $6 million or so from these 19,000 people who owe three or more parking tickets, that would really take a sizable bite out of that.
All right. And on a somewhat related note, law enforcement, parking enforcement, but more importantly, law enforcement, a new police chief was sworn in this week, Phil.
Yes, Police Chief Steve Conrad is officially the second person to run the Louisville Metro Police Department. He comes after Chief Robert White, who resigned to take the post in Denver. Many folks, you know, looking at this with some bit of fanfare in the sense that the chief next to the mayor is probably the most second recognized person in Metro government. Talked to Councilman David James, says he talked to the chief informally and just asked him to testify before the public safety panel just to talk about issues of crime and gangs. And something that Councilman James, as a former FOP president and as a former Louisville police officer, feels very passionate about. One can expect that Chief Conrad will probably take some things on that Chief Robert White did, continue some things, and make some changes. I think what people are looking forward to and seeing is what differences between Conrad and White there are. Many who are critics of White are a bit concerned because Conrad was an assistant chief under White's administration back in 2005. So many people are just waiting to see what a Conrad administration, how that will differ from Chief White. As many people know, the FOP is continuing negotiations with the city over its union contract.
So the new chief has been sworn in. He is on the job. Usually, not always, but when these new folks come in, they make some sort of big change at the beginning. But there's really no plans for that with him, right?
Yeah, when it was initially announced that, Chief Conrad was the new chief, he had made it clear that he had asked command staff to stay on, the current command staff to stay on, and many of them, most of them, agreed to stay. So we don't see any changes as far as personnel. But as far as policies, we're really waiting to see what could be changed, whether the reinstitute of the gang unit or changing the intelligence unit or shifting around certain patrols or different command units and things of that nature. We're yet to see any sort of mark that he has on his administration, but that's, you know, time to come.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Devin, let's go back to you. You covered a story this week about letter carriers in the Louisville area. This is kind of a test program nationally. You're going to be carrying antibiotics in the event of an anthrax attack.
Yeah, and the first thing Mayor Fisher wanted to make clear is that there is no reason to believe that that Louisville's in any kind of way
under any threat.
Under any threat. Uh-huh. What the program is, it partners the state, the local, and the federal government's agencies to basically provide antibiotics for anthrax within 48 hours to every home in Louisville. And the mail carriers, over 300, have agreed to volunteer to carry this medication around. What this will have to include is Mayor Fisher requesting this through the state. The state then asks the Centers for Disease Control to deliver the medications. The federal government wouldn't say exactly where those medications were kept, just that it could get to Louisville within 12 hours. At that time, the mail carriers are currently going through training to know how to deliver those medications within 48 hours.
And this would be the whole city of Louisville and possibly some other parts of adjoining counties?
Yeah, they said 240,000 homes in total.
Okay. I want to finish out our Metro segment here. Just a couple of minutes left with bourbon and pink slime. We'll start with bourbon. Erica, you have an excellent feature story running this week that people can listen to at WFPL.org about the use of genetically modified corn in bourbon distilling. What's that about?
Well, basically, about 88% of the corn that's grown in America now is genetically modified. You know, its DNA has been played with, and a lot of farmers like that because it's hardier. It's you don't have to use as many pesticides on your crops, which is obviously a positive thing. But it's also not really regulated at all in this country. It's regulated pretty much by every other developed country. And it turns out, I mean, obviously bourbon uses a lot of corn. It has to be at least 51% corn by law. Mm-hmm. And it's getting harder and harder for distillers who want to use non-GM corn to find it. I went to Four Roses, which is one of the only ones that does make a point of using non-GM corn. And that's really only because the farmers they've historically used for about 50 years are still GM-free.
What difference does it make in the distilling process?
Well, that's the thing. Maybe nothing. Mm-hmm. It's some people are leery about it just because it's not regulated. There have been some studies that have shown health effects, but those haven't really been conclusive. And in the distilling process, several distillers cited a study to me that said, basically, once you go through the distilling process, there is no genetically modified material that's left in the bourbon. So it really doesn't matter. But they actually couldn't produce those studies and comment any more on it. So, so you got that.
All right. Well, you can hear Erica's story at WFPL.org. And Gabe, we'll finish with you because you reported that another outlet has decided not to sell beef that includes what has become commonly known as pink slime.
Yeah, pink slime, it looks like pink slime, mm-hmm. and that's where it gets the name. It looks like soft serve ice cream pretty much. It's the ground up bits of these fatty parts of beef that are left over from all the other cuts in industrialized food processing. It's technically called lean, finely textured beef. Kroger will no longer sell any products that contain this filler, what people are calling pink slime. There have been a number of articles about it recently. It's treated with ammonia, and while it does meet USDA standards for meat fillers, a lot of folks are concerned about the safety of it. They're concerned about their health if they're eating it. Schools will have the option to opt out of using or having meat in the school lunches that contain this pink slime substance. The USDA has given them that option. So now Kroger previously said they would essentially label their foods and make foods without this filler available. Now they say that, you know, that's just not, it's not something that they imagine people would want in their food. They're going to sell all their food without this filler in it. They're joining Stop and Shop, Safeway, Super Value, and Food Lion have all also taken similar steps.
I don't know if you can speak to this either professionally or personally, but does pink slime enhance the flavor, or why is it added? It's just filler?
Yeah, I think it pretty much just fills it out, and you know, you can use some higher quality beef and then load it up with the slime as well to round out a beef patty or something.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but we're going to have to, because we're out of time. Thanks to our WFPL News Roundtable, Philip M. Bailey, Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. When we come back, the latest from Frankfort with Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, and then WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter Aaron Keene is going to join us with an update on the Humana Festival of New American Plays. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Hellett. Well, the Kentucky General Assembly continues in Frankfort, and here to bring us up to speed on the week's events is Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Kenny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Well, some big budget news this week. The Senate has approved its version. Any major changes from the House version?
Well, there were some changes. Whether or not they're major is up for discussion. I mean, you know, I spoke to House Speaker Greg Stumbo this morning. He qualified that, of course, he hasn't dug through the whole bill. I mean, the actual bill right here on the table, you know, flipping through it, it looks like it's 220 pages, and the Senate didn't even pass that until nearly 8 o'clock last night. So there was no way that he, you know, I guess he was watching that UofL game a little bit last night. He says he hasn't been through the bill. But he did happen to get a briefing document that kind of says what some of the differences are. The Senate did do some changes. They reduced even more debt than what the House did, about $161 million more or less debt. That's almost $600 million more than what the governor had. They cut out $7.5 million extra the governor had for preschool to expand that. But they kept other programs, the colon cancer program, the expansion of social workers that the governor called for. They did take out the kind of the UPike compromise, that Scholar Appalachian Scholarship. But Speaker Stumbo didn't even seem very concerned about this this morning. He said that, you know, he figured that was a bargaining chip, and they're going to start conference committee on Monday. And he said that, you know, there was no doubt that they wouldn't finish in time for them to pass the budget on time this session, which is probably a minor miracle in and of itself if you've been following along for the last decade.
I was going to say these budget negotiations seem less contentious than what we've seen over the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the, I guess, tough decisions, some senators would disagree with this, a lot of the tough decisions were made the last couple budget cycles, and the House kind of went along. They didn't pull any tricks. The governor didn't play any real tricks in the budget this year. The House cut a lot of debt already, did a lot of the Senate's job for them. And I think everyone just, I think their biggest priority is to pass a budget that can work, pass a road plan that can work, and then go home. You know, I think they're tired of the special sessions and, you know, going further than they have to and having all that disagreement. So there wasn't a lot of shenanigans or anything like that. And, you know, they probably will pass it on time and go through their veto period and come back. And the word that Stumbo used is I guess we're getting back to normal around here at the Capitol. I don't know what normal in the Capitol is, but I guess what we're seeing this year is normal.
And I guess one big difference is this budget did not assume a revenue from casino gambling that the governor had cleverly put in the last time.
Exactly, and since it didn't have any gambling revenues, you know, obviously, you know, when the governor did that, the House basically had to build the budget from scratch, something they haven't had to do before. So, you know, they didn't have to build this one from scratch. They could look at the governor's proposal, tweak it a little bit. The Senate could look at both proposals, look at, you know, the 2010 proposal and the 08 budget, and, you know, tweak it from there. And it seems like everyone's just going to, I don't want to say go along, but they act like it's going to be no problem at all to pass this budget, mainly because there's not a lot of money. I mean, they're cutting any extra program, most extra programs, and there's not a lot of other money to spend. There's no, you know, you can't fund a lot of new programs. You can't fund any big increase. You know, you can't do anything big. They're just struggling to fund what they currently have. So when it's something like that, as long as people don't get creative, it's usually pretty easy for lawmakers to pass a budget.
What's the status of the proposal to, for lack of a better term, regulate pseudoephedrine, the ingredient found in cold medicine?
That's been sitting in the House. It's ready to go in the House. It's got its readings. You know, I think the compromise, the 7.2 grams a month limit, is something the House can pass. They just haven't done it yet. And Speaker Stumbo said this morning that they may actually, what might happen is the Senate, which has the House Bill 4, which is the prescription pill bill that Stumbo has been pushing, they might actually just put the pseudoephedrine, you know, language into that bill and really make it a comprehensive, you know, catch-all for all these drug-related bills. I mean, don't forget, we also have one that's dealing with synthetic drugs. You know, they might throw that one in there, and in that way, they can do what they've done with education. When you talk about education reforms, everyone says Senate Bill 1, Senate Bill 1, Senate Bill 1. And if they throw the pseudoephedrine issue and the prescription pill issue and the synthetic drug issue all in one bill, then they can go on and say, you know, a few years down the road, you know, we really put a dent in our drug problem here in Kentucky with House Bill 4, House Bill 4. So my guess is that's kind of the track that they're going to go. On Monday, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to take up House Bill 4. And so, you know, you could see it come in that way. But the House isn't going to change it anymore. If it passes, it's going to be that 7.2 limit. It's going to be, I think it's modified as much as it's going to be modified, unless they throw a few of the issues in there together. And then, you know, that would be a future modification they could make.
You also reported on what's called the Young Mayor's Bill. This would lower the age eligibility to run for local office.
That's right. Representative Adam Koenig, who's from Northern Kentucky, has a bill that would allow 18-year-olds to run for city council and 21-year-olds to run for mayor. That's about a roughly 3 to 5 year decrease in the current eligibility age. And Koenig makes an argument that a lot of people make when they talk about lowering any eligibility to 18 or 21, and that is, you know, at 18 years old, you know, you have to sign up for their armed services, you're allowed to vote, you know, you can buy lottery tickets and cigarettes. You know, you're given a lot of responsibility at 18. You're pretty much not a child anymore. And if you're not a child anymore and you can vote, then you ought to be able to run and, you know, affect that change in person instead of just voting for people to kind of make the decisions for you. If you want to, you ought to be able to run yourself for a local council seat. And the same thing with the mayors. Originally, he had mayor down to 18, but there were some questions about, well, in some cases, mayors appoint like local ABC officials, alcohol beverage control officials, and, you know, have some control over that. And can a 19-year-old really make decisions about, you know, alcohol and beverage issues? So they moved that to 21, but the same thing applies. At 21, you can buy beer, you can buy alcohol. You know, surely you could run a city, because it's not like, you know, you're the only guy doing the job. There's usually city managers, there's usually a city council to double check you. There's usually, you know, checks and balances in place that, you know, your local kid can't just go wild and you know, blow the city budget at the casino.
Yeah, I never thought about that. You could really get wild and crazy if you're not very mature. But there are a lot of very sharp young people out there that would make great office holders, so I could see the argument for that. Also, there was, from the very young to the very old, a bill has been proposed that would end Confederate pensions.
That's correct. You know, that's another bill by Representative Koenig. And the argument is kind of opposite on that. It's kind of, you know, well, it's been about 50 years since anyone in Kentucky, any Confederate widows or definitely Confederate soldiers have drawn a Confederate soldier pension, so it might be time to get rid of this pension program. I mean, just completely strike all the language out of Kentucky law. No one's drawing the pensions. There's not even money in the pension fund for Confederate pensions, and it's kind of, you know, lawmakers had a little bit of fun with this because it's kind of a no-brainer to do this from an economic standpoint. No one's drawing from it. No one's taking money out of it. There's no money in it. You know, obviously there might be some people who are upset, you know, with the symbolism of it, but Koenig says that not a lot of people have come to him and said that they're against this idea, and so that's just a few steps from becoming law. You know, it would, the Senate, full Senate has to pass it. It needs the governor's signature, but basically it would rid all of that. And lawmakers had a little bit of fun with it, saying, are you sure this isn't a premature bill? Have you posted a public notice to make sure that, you know, no one could draw this? Have you double-checked? But it's really an issue that, you know, for if it hasn't happened in 50 years, why have it on the books? That's Koenig's argument.
And who knew it existed, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, Kenny Colston covers the State House and the Kentucky General Assembly for Kentucky Public Radio, which includes WFPL. Kenny, thanks for joining us, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me.
This is State of the News on WFPL. Well, we now turn our attention to the theater as the Humana Festival of New American Plays continues here in Louisville. And here to talk about that is Aaron Keene, who covers the arts and humanities for WFPL. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks, Rick.
Well, just over a week now left in the festival. What's new this week?
Last night, Lucas Naith's play Death Tax opened. It opened in the Victor Jory Theater, which is the intimate black box space at Actors Theater. It's a dense psychological thriller about end-of-life issues and, more importantly, about money and power. The premise of the play is that this wealthy nursing home patient, Maxine, gets this idea in her head that her estranged daughter is trying to have her killed before the end of the year, when some estate tax laws are going to change so that she can inherit a whole lot of money instead of just a little bit. So, and she thinks that her daughter has enlisted her nurse's help in this. So Maxine decides to make the nurse a counteroffer. And from there, plots and planning kind of spin out of control. So Nate's writing style is pretty interesting, I think. It's he relies really heavily on the extended monologue in a scene. So instead of hearing two or more actors exchanging dialogue, often what he does is employs these very long sort of single speaker monologues. And the characters tend to repeat themselves often throughout the monologue. So it creates a sort of layered textured effect, but it also gives the actors really a chance to shine because they have these extended periods of time in which they get to speak. So it's a great cast, very well acted. Although I would have to say that I think that the extended monologues do kind of drag the pace of the show down a bit, but that's something that can be tightened over time.
All right. And on another production, you spoke to Greg Kotas, I'm saying that correctly,
yes,
right?
Yes.
About his new play, which is about a 500-year-old vampire.
Yes. Michael von Siebenberg Melts Through the Floorboards opens on Saturday. And that's the final full-length play to open in the festival. And it is about a vampire. Greg Kotas won 2 Tony Awards for writing the hit musical Urinetown, which ended up really redefining the Broadway musical genre in the early, about around the turn of the century, around 2002. So his entry in the festival is kind of highly anticipated, I think. He tends to write really high concept plays. And this one is about a 500-year-old vampire who goes on a series of, bloody first dates, basically, in order to live.
And you spoke with him this week. Do we have going to play that, or we don't have that? Okay, we'll talk about Greg a little bit. Now, how does this play fit into his work overall?
Well, Kotas admits that he's kind of preoccupied with a few running themes. His Tony Award winning musical Urinetown, the concept is in the future there's a water shortage, and so private toilets have been outlawed.
Mm-hmm.
So high concept. A follow-up musical Yeast Nation is all about the sort of primordial soup, the origins of life. And those plays are really about the consequences of consumption and of growth. And so he spends a lot of time thinking about these things and what he calls the improbability of sustainability, basically how nations rise and fall also. And so he's also looking at that, at the state of, what it means to be a culture that's butting up against the edges of its own potential, as he feels the United States is now. Mm-hmm. And how does a man who's 500 years old, who's gone through so many different eras and epochs of transformation of culture and of country, how does he deal with his own crumbling transformation? How does he deal with immortality, or maybe facing, perhaps the possibility of the end of that?
So what other events are happening at the theater this weekend?
Well, it's the first of 2 industry weekends that Actors Theater puts on. And so this weekend is industry weekend 1. I don't think they're numbered for any specific reason, just gives folks some options. And so theater professionals from all over the place come into town this weekend to see the plays and to attend some other events. So we have two events that are open to the public that will also be populated with folks like directors, playwrights, agents, artistic directors, producers. So if you like to rub elbows with interesting theater folk, you have the a soiree at the BBC on at 3rd and Main on Saturday night at 10:30 p.m. It's free. It's open to the public. And it's pretty kind of casual, as they say, let your hair down kind of event. Come have a drink with and rub elbows with the theater folks. Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m. at the theater, there's a playwright forum. And so Actors has invited back several of their Humana Festival alumni, including Molly Smith Metzler, who wrote LMNOP last year, Adam Rapp, who's had several plays here as well, and Anne Washburn from last year also. So a slate of playwrights to talk about the direction of American theater and writers' concerns, things like that. It's free, but you need tickets, so contact the theater for that.
All right, and speaking of Actors Theater, the new season has been announced.
It's true. So the new season will begin September 4th, so what we have to look forward to are the every other year Shakespeare outing that that Actors Theater puts on. This year it's Romeo and Juliet. So no word yet on what sort of treatment the play is going to get, if it's going to, you know, what era it's going to be set in. People like to update Shakespeare, or at least, or sometimes retrofit it. But it will be directed by a Louisville native, YPASS grad, and former Actors Theater apprentice, Tony Especiale. So that's kind of exciting, a bit of a homecoming for him. Les Waters, the new artistic director, is going to direct two main stage plays in the upcoming season as well. He's going to do Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night, and then he's going to switch gears completely for Girlfriend, a new musical that's based on the power pop songs of Matthew Sweet. So,
wow.
Yeah, he directed the world premiere at Berklee Repertory, where he worked for 8 years before this. So it's a fairly new musical. He's directed it before. He's well acquainted with the development of the show. Says he's a huge Matthew Sweet fan. So I think Gen Xers are going to really love this one. They're going to think about it's really going to be nostalgic for them, since Matthew Sweet was such a soundtrack for a lot of people's high school and college romances.
I haven't heard that name for a while. And I missed him, too, because everybody seems to like
him. Yeah. So Matthew Sweet's making a comeback. There's going to be a Sam Shepard play, True West. And Sam Shepard lives these days on a farm outside of Midway. So he's kind of an adopted Kentuckian in that regard.
All right. Well, I want to ask you a logistical question before I let you go. When you go to a play, where do you like to sit?
Where do I like to sit?
Yeah, I mean, do you like to be close to the stage or back a little bit? I mean, what's preferable?
It depends on the theater space. Mm-hmm. So I guess if we're talking about the Humana Festival, and I'll talk about Actors Theater, if I'm in the Pamela Brown Auditorium, which is the Proscenium Theater, the big one, I like to be up front and center, maybe about third row. So you're not staring right up somebody's nostrils, but you have a nice sort of center view of the whole stage. In the Bingham Theater, there are certain seats that are sort of two seats kind of set apart, almost in tiny little balcony areas. And I like those. It makes me feel like I'm in a box, sort of, my own little box in the theater.
I'm just curious. You don't have to, but you like to go and watch a lot of productions, and just wonder where you like to sit.
That's a good question. That is a good question. Yeah, I don't like to hide in the back row. I rarely need to, although I would say that it would be convenient to beat a hasty exit when I have to write a review quickly after a show and people are kind of milling around.
All right, Aaron, thanks for joining us. Aaron Keene covers the arts and humanities for WFPL. He's got some busy weeks ahead.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks for joining us. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jarrett Clapp from the News and Tribune in Southern Indiana and Ann Marshall of Leo Weekly about the aftermath of the tornadoes that struck this area 3 weeks ago today. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. It was 3 weeks ago today that tornadoes ripped through Southern Indiana and Kentucky, killing several dozen people, injuring hundreds of others. Joining us now are two journalists who continue to cover the storm's aftermath, the recovery and rebuilding, especially in southern Indiana, Jarrett Clapp from the News and Tribune and Ann Marshall of Leo Weekly. Welcome back to the program.
Hi there. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with you, Ann, because you wrote quite a bit about that day itself, really a couple of chilling narratives recounting the afternoon of March 2nd through the eyes of some of the survivors. Let's start with Jeanette Robertson, who worked at Henryville Junior Senior High School, but it's been relocated now. And she recounted for you pretty much every moment of it.
And the most surprising thing, I think, and this is not just from her story, but others as well, is just, you know, I mean, we all sort of knew that the storms were coming, but, you know, a couple days before there had been storms, and the day proceeded really as normal until about 1 o'clock when at the high school and the schools, they got word that Louisville businesses were closing and parents started to call. And, you know, then people start thinking, well, what's going on? And, you know, then the radio or the weather radio starts chirping. But for most of the day, it was just a very normal day. And so it all just happened so quickly for people.
The school, of course, was devastated. And luckily there were were there any fatalities related to the school, or was that elsewhere in the community?
No, that was elsewhere in the community. I mean, everyone in the school, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, I think everyone just came up fine. You know, I think there might have been some minor injuries in the elementary school, but the high school folks came out. I mean, not even a ceiling tile fell on where they were kind of huddled.
Right. Now, had school dismissed, but there were some folks that were still in the school, right?
Yeah, they had dismissed early, and that's when other interviews that I did, that's when others in the community knew that something might be up, was when they saw the school buses leaving early. They thought, okay, well, that's strange. You know, school's not nothing's going on today. But they had let out early that day, and that was sort of a last-minute decision by the principal and by the district to do so.
Well, this your article is excellent. It really underscores how vicious and horrifying tornadoes are. I mean, you can take cover, but you can't do anything about the storm itself. It's just...
Right.
Just incredible. Now, you also write about two firefighters in Washington County, Indiana, New Pekin. John and Jeff Miller, no relation, but they had some grim work to do that day.
Yeah. You know, there was the family of five that passed from Indiana. And, you know, these are longtime volunteer firefighters. They knew they had both watched it come through New Pekin, and they both knew that this was going to be a bad day. And that field where the family of five's trailer was destroyed was their first stop. And they, you know, they had to go, and neighbors were telling them what to do, who was missing. And, you know, I mean, they kind of were on autopilot just trying to handle all that.
How did they seem to, the two men that you talked about, how did they seem to handle all this, even being a professional firefighter?
Yeah, I mean, the younger of the two happened to be the one to find the 15-month-old who was alive for 2 days and then eventually passed away. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's been a lot to handle. That's a lot to handle on anybody, especially a young man.
Yeah.
So, you know, they see death a lot, but this is, I think as I read in the story, this just seemed very, very callous, this sort of death, just so strange.
Now, Jeanette Robertson, the school employee, did she have any injuries in her family, or did she lose her home?
No, a lot of people had hail damage in Henryville, and she did too. But she went home to a standing house.
Good for her. Jared, you've been reporting on the aftermath and the recovery, I'm trying to say. Henryville students are back in another school this week.
Some of the students are, yes. You've got the preschoolers at Silver Creek Primary School in Sellersburg, and then you've got the elementary students at it's a temporary facility in New Albany, the former Graceland Christian Church. They started back on Wednesday. And I think students, parents, teachers, district officials all seem relieved that these kids have something to go back to that's somewhat normal.
So will they finish out the school year, I guess, pretty normally with the normal schedule, and they'll just lose some days because of this?
Right. That's the plan right now. There's still no word right now as far as when they'll be back in Henryville right now. There are some estimates, but nothing solid yet.
From the reporting that I've saw and heard, the kids seem to be very happy to be returning to school.
Yeah. I mean, we went there Wednesday to see the kids getting off the buses and getting out of the parents' cars, and they were just overjoyed. They were just happy to see the teachers, just happy to see everybody that they had been used to seeing for the last couple of weeks. And to get away from the damage, I think, was a good distraction for them.
And there was also reporting this week that, and correct me if I'm wrong with this, there was a contest by this country band Lady Antebellum to have them come play at a high school prom, and the Henryville students got involved in it.
That's correct. Actually, it's interesting how they won that contest, because a neighboring school, Silver Creek High School, actually submitted the winning video. They said, don't play here, play at Henryville. And even though there's a tour conflict for the date of their prom, they are going to have a benefit concert in May. So they're still waiting to schedule an exact place for that. But the Henryville students will have something to look forward to.
So I understand they're going to do something here in Louisville.
That's correct.
Yeah. So Well, that's good for the students at Henryville. Well, all the mechanisms are now in place. We're 3 weeks removed from this to help people get back on their feet. And, of course, it's a very long process. And we tend to forget after a while in the media and kind of move on with other things. But this is a process that's going to be going on for a long time. And is there resolve among people that you talk to in Henryville to rebuild in place?
I mean, everyone I spoke to, yes. I think that people in Henryville and other people who have survived this just feel very thankful. And I think that that's the sense that I just kept hearing. You know, everyone is just thankful that they're okay, that their loved ones are okay. They want to rebuild. They want to see their community back. And it's such a damaging event. It's also a very much a uniting event, I would say, that it really brings out a community and I don't know, there's a new sense of bonding, I think.
In about 30 seconds, Jared, is that the sense you got in your coverage?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's still some hope for the high school or the schools in general right now. They're hoping to get that facility rebuilt by September, but there's nothing out just yet. But the company that's done the contracting on it had a similar situation, Goldring, Georgia, that they completely rebuilt in 101 days, and that was three separate campuses. They've only got one to worry about here.
All right. Thanks to Jared Clapp of the News and Tribune and Ann Marshall of Leo Weekly for the update and the excellent reporting on the tornado aftermath. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's show, you can visit WFPL.org, where you can also listen to the show. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.